Hello and welcome to Animal Voices here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'll be your host today. My name is Catherine Brigantino. Big thank you to Steve Romanin for teching the show today. We have a show about vivisection lined up for you today. We will be talking with Dr. Ray Greek. He is the president and co-founder of Americans for Medical Advancement. Dr. Greek is board certified in anesthesiology and was subspecialty certified in pain management in 1993. In addition to his private practice, Dr. Greek taught at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Thomas Jefferson University School of Medicine in Philadelphia. During the course of his medical career, he performed experiments on animals and conducted clinical research. Greek now believes that the use of animals as predictive models for human drug and disease response is scientifically invalid. He argues that not only is animal research not helpful for predicting human and drug disease response, but that the prevailing animal research paradigm is dangerous for human health. So we will talk with Dr. Greek in just a few moments, but first I have a few news items to share with you today. Then we'll go to Kevin from the Vegan Hip Hop Movement and then on to the interview with Dr. Greek. So up first is a piece from the Huffington Post titled "Chinese Dog Eating Festival Banned After 600 Years Because of Social Media Outcry." A 600-year-old dog-eating festival in Jiangxi, China, was banned this week after a massive social media outcry called for its cancellation. 15,000 dogs are slaughtered annually at the festival, which commemorates a battle fought in the town. Before the battle, an invading army killed all the dogs in the town of Jiangxi to prevent being exposed by barking dogs. After capturing the town, the army ate the dog meat to celebrate. From then until the 1980s, the dogs were killed immediately before being cooked and served. Then the Chinese government intervened and banned on-site butchery. But the practice began to creep back into the festival over the past few years. Pictures of the carnage from the dog-eating festival made their way onto the internet. This year, thousands took to the internet to call for the festival to be banned. The Chinese government reacted by banning the festival. According to Global Post, sympathy for dogs has increased markedly among Chinese over the past few decades. Keeping them as pets was banned during the Cultural Revolution, but rates of ownership have risen since then. There have been some calls for a total ban on eating cats and dogs in the country, but it remains both common and socially acceptable. It's possible, though, that this recent move could signal a further shift in government sentiment toward the side of a ban. Rumors of such a ban started to escalate as early as June. Our next piece comes to us from the UK's Mail Online, and it is very appropriate considering the content of our interview. It is titled "Free at Last, Chimps Caged for 30 Years and Injected with HIV and Cruel Experiments Finally Feel the Sun on Their Faces Again." Like prisoners emerging from a lifetime behind bars, a group of chimpanzees step blinking into the sunlight with what appears for all the world to be a wave and a smile. And they have much to be joyful about, for this is the first time they have felt grass under their feet and breathed fresh air for 30 years. Though a few of the chimps were born in captivity, most were kidnapped from African jungles as babies and flown to Europe, where they were locked in metal laboratory cages to be used in a long series of experiments. Horrifyingly, their mothers, who would usually raise them for 6 years, were all slaughtered. The aim of the firm that bought them was to find a vaccine to combat AIDS. Because chimps share 99% of the gene code of humans, they seemed natural subjects for the study. But that meant they suffered terrible cruelties in the years that followed, including being injected with the HIV virus. Hooked up to machines and pumped full of chemicals, they were truly prisoners of utter despair. With no stimulation, no nurturing love, and no hope, many were driven to the brink of madness and sometimes beyond. But their ordeal finally ended on Tuesday when the 38 surviving chimps were released into a sanctuary in Austria, allowing them to feel the nurturing contact of their fellow chimps after years of being separated by bars and bulletproof glass. Now, Susie, David, Clyde, Lingoa, Moritz, and all the others will be free to enjoy the remainder of their lives together, thanks to the unstinting efforts of a 59-year-old conservationist named Michael Affhauser. The founder of an animal charity that operates in 4 European countries, he oversaw the construction of the sanctuary outside Vienna, which is built on the site of a defunct safari park. "Who knows what scars they carry on the inside," says Mr. Affhauser. They are all traumatized to greater or lesser degrees. Two of them died before the reserve was finished, but at least those that are left will have a quality of life that was unthinkable when they were prisoners of the lab. Some chimpanzees were infected with the HIV virus. Of course, they became HIV positive, but none of them, not here in Austria or anywhere else in the world, developed full-blown AIDS. Therefore, the program was useless. It achieved absolutely nothing. Several years ago, the giant American pharmaceutical company Baxter took over the Austrian laboratory and immediately announced it had no intention of continuing the testing program. More than that, its bosses decided the firm had a moral responsibility to improve the life of the chimps who can live to the age of 50 or 60. They were moved to an indoor shelter in a safari park, but when it went into liquidation in 2004, the building of an outdoor sanctuary was stopped, and the animals were forced to spend several more years in cages. But no longer. At last, says Mr. Uffhauser, they will have some dignity and some fun for what remains of their lives. So, a somewhat happy ending to what has been 30 years of torture. You are listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. We have the pleasure of being joined by Dr. Ray Greek from Americans for Medical Advancement. Dr. Greek is the president and co-founder of Americans for Medical Advancement and is board certified in anesthesiology. Dr. Greek taught at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine and Thomas Jefferson University School of Medicine in Philadelphia. And during the course of his medical career, he performed experiments on animals and conducted clinical research. Today, Dr. Greek is here to talk to us about his argument that not only is animal research not helpful for predicting human drug and disease response, but that the prevailing animal research paradigm is dangerous for human health. Dr. Greek, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, Catherine, and thank you for having me on Animal Voices.
Our pleasure. I'm hoping you can just start off by telling us about Americans for Medical Advancement.
Well, Americans for Medical Advancement is a charity in the United States of America. It's a not-for-profit. It was founded in 1999 by my wife, Jean, and myself. And that's kind of an interesting story. My wife is a veterinarian, but we started our sojourn about 20 years ago when she was still a student at the University of Wisconsin in Madison School of Vet Medicine. I was about 5 years ahead of her in training, and as a result of this, she would come home at night and ask me various questions about her patients and about diseases and treatments and so on. And it became apparent very early on that what worked in humans did not work in animals and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And in fact, diseases that animals contracted, humans did not, and vice versa. And this really led us to question whether the paradigm of using animals to predict human response to drugs and disease was really scientifically valid. So this was about 1989, and over the next 10 years, we started doing research on our own into really what could be called comparative medicine. And in 1999, we wrote a book called Sacred Cows and Golden Geese. It was our first book about animal experimentation. And in 1999, we also founded Americans for Medical Advancement, or AFMA, as we call it.
So 20 years in the making, then. That's great. So before we get into sort of the nitty-gritty about why exactly animals are not good models for humans in medical research, I'm wondering if you can tell us about the science that underpins the research that does use animals.
Well, that's a very good question, because animals are used in science and research in about 9 different ways. I won't list all 9 ways, but essentially it boils down to 3 different general categories. The categories that we're concerned about are using animals to predict human response to drugs and disease. That's one category. And in that category, animal models just flat out don't work. You cannot tell what a drug is going to do in a human by testing it on a mouse or a monkey or even a chimpanzee for that matter. And the same is true with disease response. You just cannot extrapolate between species on that level. Now, the second area involves using animals in basic research. And basic research, again, is a broad field But really what basic research means is we're doing research just to see how things work. Okay, we just want to discover new data. We want to discover new molecules in living tissue. We want to discover new pathways in living tissue. And there's no claim in basic research that any of this is going to be even remotely useful to human medicine. Okay, these people are doing research to add knowledge to the world. Now, sometimes that knowledge does go on to benefit humans, but a vast, vast majority of time it does not. And the third way, the third area, I guess you could say, where animals are used is really as factories, you might say. Let's say that we want to produce the polio virus. Well, we can infect monkeys with polio, and we can have a constant supply of polio from their blood and from their tissues. Another example would be insulin. We used cows and pigs for factories to produce insulin from about 1925 until roughly 2000. I don't remember exactly when we started using recombinant DNA to produce human insulin, but that is what is mainly used today. So those are the three general areas. And the second and third areas, the use of animals in basic research and the use of animals as factories, those are scientifically viable. Area number two is almost a tautology. I mean, if you want to discover new facts, then conducting experiments will no doubt help you discover new facts. And that's all the claim is in basic research. And using animals in area number three as factories or bioreactors or for spare parts or for whatever, that too is something that works simply because of the commonalities among mammals. But the first area is really how animal experimentation is sold to society. You know, it's your dog or your child. If we don't test this drug on a monkey, it could kill your mother. We're never going to find a vaccine for HIV unless we use chimpanzees, and so on and so on. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so if I'm understanding you correctly, animals are used as models for disease, and that's where the predictive ability of animal models comes into question for you.
Exactly.
And they're also used as test subjects, but in those cases, there's no claim that they can predict outcomes for humans. And in those cases, you're saying that's actually quite successful because maybe you can say more about that.
Well, again, area number two, the use of animals in basic research, has no goal. The only goal that a basic researcher has is to discover new knowledge. And that's why I say it's almost a tautology, because anytime you do an experiment, if you're a scientist, you're probably going to discover something new. If nothing else, you'll at least discover, you know, you'll perfect your technique on how to do that experiment. Or you'll teach another grad student how to do that experiment. So knowledge is almost always gained in basic science research, but rarely does that knowledge benefit humankind in terms of curing diseases or telling us more about human diseases or leading to treatments for human diseases. So applied research has the goal of predicting human response. And that just flat out doesn't work. Whether it's disease or drug evaluation, it simply doesn't work. Basic science, on the other hand, it has no goal. So, you know, by definition, it works. It just doesn't result in cures and treatments.
Can you tell us more about the seeming choice that we have to make between humans and animals? You know, there are these billboards that are popping up that say, you know, who would you rather see live? And there's a picture of a child and a mouse. And we see this rhetoric repeated over and over again, your child or your dog. We need to pick either humans or animals. Can you speak to that?
Certainly. That is the classic false dichotomy that the animal experimentation industry presents to the unsuspecting public. Your child or your dog. Either we do research on mice or this baby on this billboard is going to die. And that is a classic example of a false dichotomy. And that is how animal experimentation is sold to society. We have to do this because animal models predict human response. We have to test these drugs on animals to make sure they're safe for people. And that's the whole fallacy of animal-based research. animal-based research does not do what that billboard portrays it to do. It does not make drugs safer. It does not tell us disease mechanisms in humans. It does not do the things that the animal experimentation industry claims that it does. What it actually does in the final analysis is animal models are a heuristic device. Okay? They're an aid in thinking new thoughts, in developing new ideas. But the difference between other heuristic devices and animal models is, of course, that animals are sentient and animals are valued by society. A very famous scientist once was trying to figure out how to put a catheter into the heart. And specifically, he wanted this catheter to go into the heart, through the heart, and into the pulmonary artery. And he just couldn't figure out how to do that because the catheter would go into the heart and it would coil up and it would get stuck and it was just a mess. So one day this individual was in Southern California. He was on the beach and he saw some sailboats. And as a result of seeing those sailboats, what he did was he went back to his lab. He put a little balloon, an inflatable balloon, on the very tip of that catheter. And then the catheter was able to ride the blood flow through the heart and into the pulmonary artery, just like a sail uses the wind to go across the ocean. Now, that's an example of using sailboats as a heuristic device, okay? And it worked. That catheter is now called a pulmonary artery catheter or a Swan-Ganz catheter, Dr. Swan being the scientist that I was talking about. So virtually anything on Earth can be a heuristic device. And you will occasionally see animals used as heuristic devices where something good comes of it. Okay? But the difference between using sailboats as heuristic devices and using animals as heuristic devices is that no one is going to spend billions and billions of dollars funding researchers to go sit on the beach of Southern California and watch sailboats. Although arguably the success rate from watching sailboats is far greater than the success rate of using animals in basic research. So we really have to talk about probabilities when we talk about using animals in research. The probability that an animal is going to predict human response is essentially nil. And the probability that using sentient animals is going to result in cures or treatments for disease approaches nil. It's not nil, but it's very, very low. On the other hand, we could be studying human beings. I mean, what a novel idea. Let's study the species that we're trying to cure. We don't study cows when we're trying to cure horses. We study horses. So there are a lot of research techniques that can be used on humans that are very ethical, that are done every day, but these things are not very well funded, and these things need to get a lot more government funding. We need to stop funding experiments on animals. We need to start funding human-based research that is ethical and productive.
I'm glad you mentioned funding. I want to come back to that, but on the line of thinking about probability, I'm looking here at the National Institute of Health's fact sheet, and it's called the Medical Research with Animals Fact Sheet. And under Table 1, titled Medical Research with Animals Saves Lives, they've actually cited various animal models and the medical benefit for people. So they have well-known, sort of commonplace ones that are reproduced in this fact sheet. So, you know, dog, discovery of insulin, monkey, polio vaccine, mouse, rabies vaccine, pig.
Yeah,
and it goes on and on. Yeah.
Yeah, let's just stop right there and analyze those first two a little bit more thoroughly. Actually, we did not conduct research on dogs to find insulin. Okay, we did find insulin in dogs, but we use dogs as what you might call a factory or a bioreactor, okay? So when Banting and Best and colleagues purified insulin, they did get that insulin from a dog. But they could have just as easily gotten that insulin from human cadavers who had recently died. They could have gotten their pancreas and done exactly the same thing to their pancreas that they did to the dog pancreas, and for that matter, what was done to the pancreases of pigs and cows for several decades thereafter. The way that diabetics survived in the 1930s, 40s, and so forth was from the insulin that was harvested from pigs and cows. Now, obviously, the people who harvested that insulin did not repeat Banting and Best's experiment every time they harvested the insulin. They learned how to harvest the insulin, and that's all there was to it. And that insulin could have come from anywhere. Okay, so you cannot claim, as this website does, that insulin would not have been discovered or purified had it not been for the dog. That's like saying we would have never discovered cells if we hadn't looked at a cork plant underneath a microscope. That's nonsense. Now, that's how cells were discovered, okay? The first scientist to do that looked at dead plant material from cork, and he saw little things that to him looked like cubicles, and he called them cells. But as we know, every living organism is made of cells. We could have discovered cells by looking at other plants. We could have discovered cells by looking at human skin. We could have discovered cells in probably a million different ways. So it is very disingenuous to say that if it had not been for the dog or another animal model, that we would not have been able to discover or use penicillin. That is simply not the case. And it is disingenuous to the point of fraud, in my opinion, to make that claim. So animals and humans do have things in common. If you want to learn what that big organ in the center of the chest does, you know, you can look at a cow or a pig or a human and figure out that the heart pumps blood. But number one, that's not what animal research or animal-based research is sold to the public as doing. Animal experimentation is sold to the public as making their drug supply safer and informing scientists about human diseases, and the discovery and purification of insulin is not an example of that process. It's an example of using animals as bioreactors or using animals as factories. The exact same thing is true of polio, only with polio there's a slight twist. As I was saying, monkeys can be used to grow the polio virus so that if you ever want to use the polio virus or study the polio virus, you can extract a sample from the monkey and there's your polio virus. This is not using animals to predict human response to drugs and disease. Again, it's using the animal as a living refrigerator, really. The flip side to the coin is that researchers had everything they needed to make the polio vaccine around 1910, 1920. However, based on monkey experiments, they thought that polio entered the human brain and the human nervous system through the nose. This was 100% based on studies in monkeys. Mm-hmm. In point of fact, the polio virus enters the human bloodstream through the gut. You swallow it, it goes into your intestines, and it is absorbed. Because of that mistake, that monkey mistake, the polio vaccine was delayed for about 40 years. So this is a very good example of what you can use animals in science for as living refrigerators and what you cannot use them for, to predict human response to drugs and disease. And what that website should say is that millions of people died between 1920 and the 1950s when the polio vaccine was finally invented, and it was invented through in vitro research, not through animal-based research, because of the misleading nature of the disease in monkeys. So those are two examples that, yes, everybody uses those examples. They're very disingenuous. And if you really take a hard look at all of the examples that the vested interest groups put forth, well, number one, they're the vested interest groups, so that should give you a clue, you know, in terms of what you're dealing with. But if you really look at these examples scientifically, and you go back and you look at the history, and you look at what was possible and what was not possible, and the results, there are a lot of stories just like the two that I just told. Penicillin is another one. Fleming originally tested penicillin on a rabbit, and because of the results from the rabbit, he put it on the shelf for a decade. Okay, now this was during a time when humans didn't have antibiotics. You know, a scratch on the arm could be deadly. And based on this study with rabbits, Fleming just discarded penicillin. He thought it wasn't going to work. It would be another 14 years before penicillin was available to the general public. That's what you don't hear about when they talk about animal models of human disease.
Yeah, so it sounds like animals as models for human disease is actually quite counterproductive. I'm wondering if we can talk about funding. Now, who is funding medical research with animals?
For the most part, medical research with animals is funded by the taxpayer. Pharmaceutical companies also do research with animals, and they certainly contribute a fair share to the use of animals in science and research. But by and large, animal-based research is funded by governments in the form of grants to researchers who are at universities or perhaps private research institutions. And of the money in the United States that goes to medical research in general, probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% goes to animal-based research. So if the National Institutes of Health give out grants in the neighborhood of $30 billion a year, probably $15 billion of that is going to go to animal-based research.
So a significant portion of the tax money that people contribute to research does end up funding animal-based research.
It's certainly a plurality of the research dollars, and it's probably a majority, yes.
Okay. So before the break, we were talking about the counterproductive effects, essentially, of using animals as models in research. So, I mean, this question might be a little too obvious, but why do medical research with animals if it is, in fact, historically, time and time again, counterproductive?
We just answered that question, Catherine. That $15 billion a year is the answer to that question. Yeah. But what you have to understand is that in the United States, a vast majority of funding goes to what's called basic research, and a vast majority of that basic research is research that involves animals. All right. So if you have a PhD and you want to do science research, biological science research, and you have the opportunity to work with humans or to work with animals, right off the bat, twice as much money is going to go to the research that involves animals as to the research that involves humans. So you're looking at a bigger piece of the pie if you focus on animal-based research than if you focus on human-based research. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, if you're in the United States and you're in academia, you get promoted and you get tenured and you get salary increases based on how many papers you publish in the scientific literature. You can probably publish 5 to 7 papers that revolve around animal-based research during the time it would take you to publish one good paper on human-based research. Mm. So the system is really stacked in favor of doing animal-based research, and that's not an accident, because most of the people who sit on these committees in the government that end up funding research are themselves animal experimenters. Hmm. So, you know, the whole system, there's a lot of institutional inertia here. An entire system has grown up over the past 70 years that favors using animals in research over studying humans. And it's all driven by money.
I'm wondering, at what point do research results from animal studies actually get applied to humans? Like, can you tell us more about this process?
Well, a vast majority of the time they don't, and when they do, they usually don't work. Most of the time, I'll just give you one statistic, 9 out of every 10 drugs that are tested in humans, in human clinical trials, fail. Either because the animal model was wrong about toxicity or because the animal model was wrong about efficacy. Hmm. So either the drug doesn't work in humans after it worked in mice and monkeys, or the drug kills the liver in the human or kills the kidneys in the human or whatever. So most of the time we spend billions of dollars and we have absolutely nothing to show for it. Hmm. Now I will give you an example. a recent example of where research in animals has translated to humans and where it has translated very well. I would say that this is a tremendous scientific breakthrough and may one day lead to medical breakthroughs. And that is, by using fruit flies, scientists were able to find a group of genes that in both flies and humans, and essentially in all animals, is responsible for laying out our body's plan. In other words, the head is on top, the chest is in the middle, the arms come off the shoulders, the legs come off the pelvis, that type thing. Mm. And these genes are called homeobox genes, and they were discovered in fruit flies. Now, I don't think fruit flies are sentient. Maybe some of your listeners do. But the use of fruit flies is, in my opinion, ethically uncontroversial, and it is of scientific great value. And where we are today is not where we were in the 1700s and 1800s. In the 1700s and 1800s, we didn't know what the pancreas did. We didn't know what the liver did. And if you want to figure out just what, on a gross level, the major organs of the body do, you know, you can study most any mammal and figure that out. Mm. Okay, those are not the questions that we're asking today. Today, the questions that we're asking really can only be answered by studying these very, well, I shouldn't say simple organisms, but organisms that are less complex than mammals. So fruit flies, there's a worm that is used frequently in medical research called C. elegans. Yeast is used a lot in medical research. And what we're finding by studying these less complex organisms is the very building blocks of life. And this is scientifically exciting, and it will also eventually lead to medical breakthroughs. But we're kind of to the point in medicine where the stuff that we need to learn cannot be learned by studying monkeys and mice and dogs and cats. We really need to study yeast and fruit flies in order to keep advancing the knowledge that we're going to need in 20 or 30 years. Does that make sense?
I'm following you. I'm still sort of, to be honest, when I hear fruit flies, there's no ethical controversy there. I don't know. I feel like the jury is kind of still out.
I agree. I think the jury is out on fruit flies. But if I had to decide right now, I would probably lean to saying that they're not sentient. Now, that may change. I mean, I totally agree with you that it may not that could change in the future. But fruit flies do not raise the same ethical concerns that, say, chimpanzees do.
Well, I mean, on that note, I did open the show with a news piece about chimpanzees that were released from a research facility that was injecting them with HIV in the hopes that they could study AIDS, and recently they've been released to sanctuary. And even in this article that is very much sympathetic to the hardships of the chimpanzees, they say something along the lines, because chimps share 99% of the gene code of humans, they seem natural subjects for the study. So can you tell us more about this? Why, I mean, somebody that's so seemingly similar to us, it seems they are really the natural pick. Why not study them? We're so similar.
If an animal model was going to reproduce human response to drugs and disease, it would be the chimpanzee. All right. Hmm. The fact that the chimpanzee does not reproduce human response to drugs and disease really settles the whole prediction argument, okay? And your reasoning is exactly correct. Genetically and evolutionarily, we are most similar to the chimpanzee. Mm. But here's the problem with that. In the old days, we thought that genetic similarity was all there was to it. But then we noticed a few complicating factors. One complicating factor is the fact that identical twins, which are now called monozygotic twins, don't always react the same way to drugs, despite being raised in the same house, going to the same school, eating the same food. Mm-hmm. They don't always react the same way to drugs, and they don't always come down with the same diseases. Matter of fact, if one twin comes down with multiple sclerosis, there's only about a 50-50 chance that the other twin will come down with multiple sclerosis. Now, the genetic similarity between identical twins is far greater than the genetic similarity between chimpanzees and humans. And yet, one twin does not respond the same as the other. Well, now we understand that there's a lot more to genetics than just the amino acid sequences that are 99% similar between humans and chimps. What we find is that there are two kinds of genes. There are structural genes, okay, the genes that actually do the work, make the proteins and so forth. But there are also regulatory genes. And the regulatory genes tell the structural genes when to turn off and when to turn on. And you could, the way to think of this is think of a piano. You know, the keyboard on a piano is the same whether you're in Australia or Canada or Jamaica. A piano is a piano. And yet, we can produce very different tunes on the piano. So the structural genes are like the keys of a piano, but the regulatory genes are the sheet music. Okay, the regulatory genes tell you which key to press, how long to press it, how often to press it, and so on and so on. So you can take basically the same genes that are in a human and make almost every other mammal on the planet. Okay, that's how genetically similar we are. Now, granted, mice have a few genes that humans don't have, chimpanzees have a few genes that humans don't have, and vice versa. But by and large, you can make pretty much any mammal by using the same set of genes. For example, humans have the gene that in mice allows them to grow their tail. All right. The difference between humans and mice is not that humans lack that gene. It's that during our embryogenesis, it's never turned on. And the same thing is true with pretty much all the other organs, how the organs are shaped, where they are in the body, and so on and so on. But very, very tiny differences in regulatory genes or in what are called modifier genes and background genes and epigenetics, very, very tiny differences can mean the difference between life and death, for example, when you're exposed to HIV. Chimpanzees don't die from HIV. Humans do. And the difference between the human and the chimpanzee is incredibly slight. But on the genetic level, really, really tiny differences can mean the difference between life and death. So, really, all of this knowledge has come to us over the past 10 to 15 years. So, for the first time in the animal rights movement or the anti-vivisection movement, we have some of the best proof that is available in science that using animals to study human response to drugs and disease is not going to work. Okay? Before the Human Genome Project, we had a lot of empirical evidence, we had a lot of examples, but now the scientific case to be made is as strong as the theory of evolution. I mean, it is just rock solid.
I mean, so if we throw out all of the pain and suffering that animals have to endure for scientific testing on them to happen, if we just ignore that completely, scientifically, it is just completely invalid. Is that fair?
If you're trying to predict human response to drugs and disease, it's completely invalid. But remember, a lot of researchers will tell you that's not what they're trying to do. A lot of researchers will tell you we're just doing research for research's sake. We just want to learn neat things about mice. Now, if that's all they want to do, you know, that's fine. But the problem with that is when they submit their grant application, okay, to NIH or wherever they submit it to, I can guarantee you that somewhere in that grant application, they don't say we just want to study mice for the sake of studying mice. What they say is we want to study mice so that we can cure Alzheimer's in humans. Or we want to study mice so hopefully we can prevent babies from being born with birth defects. And that's where the fraud comes in. Because when you ask the government for money to do something and then you use that money for a totally different purpose, that's fraud. And that's what these guys are doing when they make their grant applications to do basic research. And what they say they're doing is trying to cure human disease. Do you see the difference between that? Because, again, basic research is largely a tautology. We just want to learn things about life. Well, that's relatively easy to do. You just study various forms of life. But when you start to say, we want to study various forms of life so that we can cure Alzheimer's, you're no longer doing basic research. Now you're doing applied research. And that applied research has been proven, both empirically and theoretically, not to work. So that's a big deal.
So knowledge for knowledge's sake is, I mean, it's really not a problem within scientific communities. There's no reason to challenge the ethical nature of doing experiments with animals just for the sake of doing experiments with animals.
Well, there's not a scientific reason not to do those studies, but there are huge ethical reasons not to do those studies. I mean, when you go to an animal rights protest or an anti-vivisection protest, all the signs that you see of monkeys in restraint chairs or monkeys with electrodes in their heads, that's all basic research. That's not using animals to try and predict human response to drugs and disease. But the reason that the researchers are able to get society's permission to use animals in basic research in that fashion is because they're making promises that they can't keep. So the ethical argument against using animals in research, in my opinion, falls on deaf ears as long as society thinks that, you know, using animals is going to cure children of birth defects, it's going to prevent HIV and AIDS, it's going to cure Alzheimer's, and so on and so on. But in point of fact, animal-based research is not going to do that. All these heinous photos that you see are of basic research. And I don't think that if society really understood how animals are being used, I don't think society would allow that. So in my opinion, what the animal rights movement and the animal protection movement should focus on is not the ethical argument. Vivisection has always been considered a necessary evil. It has always been considered evil. But the necessary part has trumped the evil part. And if we can explain to society that all of this research that they don't like doesn't really have a chance of resulting in cures for human disease, I think that there will be an outcry from society, and I think that research will stop. But it's not going to stop as long as society thinks that's the way cancer is going to be cured. It's just not going to happen.
So when it comes to science, when ethics are competing with science, science is going to win. So if I'm understanding you correctly, sort of the focus of animal rights organizations who are challenging vivisection should be more so on the science than the ethical argument.
Yeah, I think people respond to what's in their best interest. And if you show them that it is not in their best interest to strap monkeys to chairs and put electrodes in their brains, whether they like monkeys or not will have nothing to do, you know, with their decision. They don't like the fact that money is being wasted. They don't like the fact that, you know, the research pie is finite. If 50% of the money is going to animal-based experiments, then that's 50% of the money that's not going to human-based studies. So, yes, I think that society, especially in the U.S. right now, is very fiscally concerned. They're concerned about how the government is spending their money. And if you can point out cases where there is fraud and waste, the public gets very upset about that. And then on top of that, like I said, vivisection is considered by everybody to be a necessary evil. You take away the necessary and all you're left with is the evil. Even people who eat meat and hunt don't like vivisection, but it's considered necessary, so they tolerate it. So I think the key to getting rid of vivisection is in the science. I mean, we've been protesting against vivisection for over 150 years based on ethical grounds. During that 150 years, the number of animals used in research has skyrocketed. Okay, it's been an exponential increase. And I would argue that the experiments themselves have actually become far more heinous over the past century. But like Einstein said, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result. People are going to do what is in their best interest. That's our nature. And if you can explain to people why it's not in your best interest to torture monkeys, then I think you can make a good argument, and I think you can see the end of vivisection. But as long as it's a necessary evil, the necessary part is going to win.
I'm wondering, I mean, do you have, can you share perhaps some tips on how non-scientists like myself or grassroots activists and organizations can better challenge vivisection on their own, because there's certainly a gap between grassroots activism and the scientific community. I think that's pretty fair to say. So how can we build a bridge? Is that possible? Do you have any tips, suggestions? What do you think?
No, I think that's a very good question, Catherine, and I would give you three suggestions. The first thing that I would suggest that everybody do is educate themselves. So one of the books that I've written is called FAQs about the Use of Animals in Science. That book is scientifically very current. All right, I just wrote it a couple of years ago, and it contains very good arguments that if the animal activist learns, he or she can make within their own peer group. So first of all, I think you need to educate yourself. The second thing is, you can't be me, okay? The non-scientist will never be able to challenge a vivisector on his own home turf. That's just not possible. I don't argue engineering with engineers because I don't know as much about it as they do, okay? Mm-hmm. I'm not an expert in that field. So while the animal activist can certainly argue with people in their own peer group, their friends, their family, and so on, and I think that is incredibly important, they need to realize their limitations. And this leads me to my third point, which is what I would like to see the animal community do is try and educate their immediate environment, their friends and their family, and then try to interact with universities in hopes of getting me to come there and do a debate or do a series of lectures and so on and so on. Because I can take on the researchers on a one-on-one basis. And as you just saw in Toronto, they won't do that. Hmm. And when they refuse to do that, you can point that out to the media, and then we can start to educate through the media more and more people. But I think there has to be a confrontational approach in the end. And by confrontational, I don't mean violence. I mean, why won't they stand up on a stage and debate Dr. Ray Greek on this science issue, not an ethical issue, just the science? You know, why won't they do that? And I think if people focused more on bringing that to the attention of the media, I think you would go a lot further.
And just to bring listeners who aren't aware that you just did a talk in Toronto up to speed. So, right, so you just did a talk at University of Toronto, well known for using animals in testing, and you challenged University of Toronto scientific community to engage in a debate with you, and there were no responses. Can you tell us more about
that? There were definitely responses.
Okay.
That the responses were negative.
Okay.
The university in mass refused to participate in this debate, and that should offend your listeners on many levels. Number one, as an institution of higher learning, that's where debates are supposed to take place. If you can't have a debate on a controversial issue in a university, where can you have that debate? Mm. Right now in the United States, there are certain facets of the animal rights movement that are getting violent. And I condemn that. I condemn that on all levels. But
that's another
I
show,
understand
though.
It. Right. But I understand it. And the reason that some of them, I think, are doing this is because they've tried peaceful protests, they've tried to get universities to debate me, and the universities have refused. Well, John F. Kennedy said something to the effect of, those who make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. Mm-hmm. So when a university refuses to account in a public fashion for how it's using government money, when it refuses to explain science to the general public, we have a problem. And that problem goes way beyond the use of animals in science. We have a problem with corruption on a more fundamental level. So I think everybody should be concerned about this, regardless of how you feel about animals.
Dr. Greek, we only have a few minutes left. I'm wondering if you can give our listeners a little bit of information of how they can find Americans for Medical Advancement, maybe some, you know, where they can find resources, maybe plug your books.
Sure, thank you for that opportunity. Our website is afma-curedisease.org, or you can just search in whatever search engine you use, Americans for Medical Advancement, AFMA are the initials. The books are available through most any online bookseller. And the book that I would really recommend for your listeners is FAQs, or frequently asked questions, we abbreviated in the title FAQs, about the use of animals in science. That book is written for the non-scientist, but it has very current scientific information that is by far and away the best book I've ever written for non-scientists. If there are any scientists who are interested in this subject, we have a book titled Animal Models in Light of Evolution. I would suggest that if you don't have a doctorate in science, you don't try and read that book. It's pretty heavy going. But the FAQs book I would recommend to everybody.
Dr. Greig, thank you so much for being on the show. You're listening to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. We were just talking with Dr. Greig from Americans for Medical Advancement. Thank you so much to Steve Romanen for teching the show, and we'll see you next week.